see. I didn't do too many consults because I was having cataract surgery and all that. Well, I just didn't know whether or not, I knew you were supposed to get better fast from it, but I didn't know, you know, if you get a big dog, that they're not supposed to pick up 40 pounds. And I could just see me having this dog that pulled like crazy and, you know.
Really?
40 pounds. But some interesting things. The I did a consult with a couple who has, they have a flock guard. This is a follow-up consult, because the first consult was for, they got a Pyrenees, Great Pyrenees, and this was about a year ago, I think. So they got a Great Pyrenees, and the dog walker complained that the dog was stubborn and wouldn't walk. Well, we know Great Pyrenees have a tendency to be somewhat stubborn and won't walk because they don't see any real reason to walk. But anyway, so I came down to their house and I took the dog outside and I walked around and I actually had her go up a hill and I had her trying to walk out the driveway and stuff. And after about 15 minutes, I said to the guy, the wife wasn't there, but I said to the guy, you know, she's sick. Don't make her do this. She's sick. There's something wrong. And he goes, are you sure? Because the vet checked everything. And I said, nope, she's sick. There's something wrong. And I said, you know, I'm not going to charge you. Take her to the vet right away. Make sure she's okay, because I don't think she is. She had heartworm.
Oh.
So
wow.
If they had made her do a whole bunch of stuff, she would have died.
Her.
Oh.
Yeah, because heartworm, if they're too energetic on heartworm, it just causes a heart attack. And they die. The worms break off.
Yeah.
So I'm like, so, and I've done this before with dogs, and you've got a sick dog, and usually what it amounts to for most of the dogs is because they have hip dysplasia or knee problems, and that's the reason that they're reactive, is because they're scared enough of the rest of the world that they kind of are proactive about reactivity. If you can say that, I don't know if you can. So they got another dog. So she went through a heartworm treatment. She's fine. She's never going to be truly energetic because she's a Great Pyrenees, but she's fine. She can go on walks. So now they got this new one, and he's about 2 years old. And she said she thought he was a Kuvaz, and he's got multiple dew claws, and that usually means they're a Great Pyrenees. And I said might be just a really skinny Great Pyrenees. Because the Great Pyrenees that's one of their signature things. There are only two types of dogs that have those clusters of dew claws, and that's Great Pyrenees and the Norwegian Lundehund. How about that?
Say
one?
That again.
That's a Norwegian Lundehund. We actually have one in the shelter for neutering, I think. And since there are like five of the breed left, it was a shame. But what they used their multiple dew claws for was climbing up the insides of, climbing up cliffs to get puffin eggs.
Wow.
Because that's what they were used to hunt, was puffins and puffin eggs in Norway. So, yes, that was just showing off. Anyway, so they get this second dog, and he's a really nice dog. And so we were just working with the dog. And we hadn't realized it, but when I came in, she'd left, they have a gate, their gated house. They'd left the gate open. And she suddenly realized that the gate was open and he was not on leash. And he left. And I'm like, oh, God. Because a lot of dogs would leave and come back and play games with you and you can't catch me and all that kind of stuff. But this dog, of course, was, I'm leaving. I'll be back in 3-4 days, okay? Maybe. Because it's a flock guard. And they have, the two major problems that flock guards have are wanderlust and territoriality, and go figure on that.
It's all their territory. Those are like.
Yeah, no, but they're, if they're in territory, they are very protective of their territory, but they do have wanderlust. So it's like Strider, my German Shepherd, who had high degree of territorial defense. And he also had separation anxiety and wanderlust. Nobody said
don't
they had to be really, really, you know, kind of, but consistent. They're not really. So yesterday, one of my consults yesterday was, I had two interesting consults, and the second one I actually want to ask you about. The first one was a pit bull and Rhodesian Ridgeback mix. Now, Rhodesian Ridgeback, we know we've talked a lot last couple of weeks ago about pit bulls. Rhodesian Ridgebacks are one of the protective breeds. So they're along the lines of Rottweilers and things like that. So that would indicate that they have a high degree of territoriality, that they definitely feel very protective towards their owners. But it also means that in many, many Rhodesian Ridgebacks, you see a high degree of suspicion and fear. Because suspicion is fear, isn't it? It's fear which is kind of held in check, I guess. Like, I don't know who that is. So we have a breed, one of the breed specs for the pit bull is frontal approach, what we talked about last time. And the thing about Rhodesian Ridgebacks is the suspicion. And this dog is one of the most suspicious pitty mixes I've seen in a long time. Really, really fearful, very suspicious. She's had him since he was 7 weeks old. I think they've done a good job, or a relatively good job, of raising the youngster. But once he gets to know you, he gets really frontal. So again, you know, dogs are complex. So he's suspicious, he barks and growls, then he wants to play, and then he wants to jump up on you and push at you, right? And then if I moved, which meant get up or even pick up something, he would go, but he'd be right next to me now. Because he doesn't have the space that most protective dogs do. So he's not, or like a herder dog, you know, is gonna have this like 3-4 feet of space that they wanna keep distance, but he didn't have that at all. She had actually put in her behavior history form that he had been biting her on her ankles and she wanted to fix that. And she gets in and I get into the door and the dog is like, you know, dilated eyes, going back and forth, all that stuff. And she said, I'm a little worried about this. And I said, well, at 8 months old, you should be really worried about it because it's not, you know. So we talked about fear and grip periods and stuff like that. And that was really for her. I think the dog is genetically fearful, and I think that it's going to be a problem for the dog's entire life. She's pretty committed to the dog, so I think it would take a real, really horrible picky incident in order for something to happen, and I sincerely hope it doesn't happen. They're good owners. So anyways, these are just kinds of examples of breed-specific behavior that it's like you go into a consult thinking this is dog, and you come out going, wow, that was type B. That was so typical of this breed. That was so typical of the way this breed sees the world. I'm ordering, by the way. How to waste your money. I'm ordering a little camera that you hang from a dog's collar.
Oh, yeah.
And turn on. Because I really want my clients to see their dogs through the dog's eyes. Because they don't see that. They, you know, we see everything from way up here, and they see everything from way down there, and the world is completely different. And it was pointed out to me a while back that if we were so close to the earth and to the grasses and all that, we would probably be using our noses a lot more too.
Yeah.
It's not that we have bad noses, it's that just we're very distant from all the things that are. So what this person did was go up and smell trees and stuff like that. She probably looked really good. So, but the fact is that I think I probably agree with her. So I'm going to get that camera. That's cool. What the heck? Yeah.
So when you have these breeds that have these traits, for instance, the healers have the, like, they can be protective. Is it because the dog, I mean, it's obviously genetic, but like, are these dogs assuming they have to be protective? Like, even if you're not presenting, even if you're not having all the same kind of thing, are they just going to be protective? Because that's what I've heard about healers. Like, well, they're protective.
Dogs. Yes, they are.
And you, even if you have strong, you know, I mean, I don't feel like I have to be like,
yes, even if you have leadership.
Yeah.
My old boss at Marine Humane Society, the person who hired me at Marine Humane Society, had a, she had a German Shepherd, and he was a magnificent dog. He was really wonderful. She did search and rescue with him, and he was great. And then she had a little dog, I can't remember what the little dog was. And then she got a healer because she was dead sure that she could teach the healer to not be a healer. And it did not work. He absolutely, she was a really good trainer, and he was still a healer. He still was very suspicious of the world. He was, I mean, she did not give in to his stuff. She thought obedience was going to fix everything. And obedience does. You've got a healer, you've got a healer. That's what they are. They're not, it's not that a good healer is wonderful because they know the difference between something that's really scary and something that's not really scary. And that has to do with socialization and observation of the world and care and the way you deal with it. But their tendency is to kind of, usually at social maturity, to stop thinking the world is a safe place and start thinking it's a place they need to take care with. So now your girl is a mix, right?
I believe so. Yeah,
yeah, she looks like a mix to me.
Like a mix.
So, you know, you're not going to get that full healer.
Well,
border collies are just dead serious about everything. Border collies are like, you know, what do they call, you say, what is it, how many feminists does it take to change a light bulb? That's not funny. That's a wicked thing to say. I do this stuff and it's on tape, but I have to get it. Anyway, that.
Part stand up, part training.
Yeah. There. Okay, so on to northern breeds. Northern breeds actually didn't factor in all that much in the very beginning because most people didn't get. You didn't see very many Huskies 10 years ago. You didn't see very many Malamutes and all that. But nowadays, we have tons and tons of Huskies. They became, for some reason or other, a dog of choice. And I think what happens with a lot of Huskies is they get these dogs and they find out exactly where that hair goes. And they don't want the Husky anymore because, man, do they have a lot of hair. You can definitely knit from a Husky or a Malamute's coat. There's no question about it. So their shedding is one of the biggest problems with them. But there are characteristics besides shedding. They tend to be very independent. They tend to be free thinkers. They are highly predatory. Not all of them, but most of them. And they have very, very clear, lovely body language. So you know exactly what they're thinking and what they're intending to do. Now, the reason that they're like this is because that's what they were bred to do. You know, they're bred to pull. When you think about it, I mean, if you go to the sites where you can learn about the training of the sled dogs for the Iditarod and whatnot, what are they trained to do? Pull. And then G and Ha. And I can't remember which one is left and which one is right.
G is left.
Huh?
G is right, Ha is left.
Ha's left, huh? and whoa. Well, actually, no, they don't do whoa. They don't stop. In order, Huskies don't stop. There's a break on the sled, but they don't respond to a word for stopping. So they learn essentially pull, which they do as soon as the break is taken off, and then they learn left and right, and that's pretty much it. So they didn't breed them to look back at the leader, at the person, and take instructions from the person. Because if they did, they would go off the trail. Right? So they're only geared at going forward or going left or going right. Oddly enough, when you bring them into our society, they don't exactly think the sit down, come and stay are...
It's so strange.
They're not necessary.
Why do you want that?
You put a harness on them, a backflip harness.
And they will pull you. So, you know, you could certainly do scooter training with them. Yeah. You can do all kinds of stuff where you actually get pulled. But that's the other things that are that they are independent, again, because nobody expected them to do anything besides the thing that they were going to be doing. And so it's not like they relied on people for much of anything, except for presumably food. So this is what we get. This happens to be a Malamute. The difference between a Malamute and a Husky sometimes is very difficult to see. Malamutes are pullers of heavy things. Like Malamutes pull up to 2,000 pounds for short distances. That is really a lot of pulling. And whereas Huskies are speed animals, and then some of the other. And by the way, the Iditarod, they very rarely use purebred Huskies for anything. Most of them are mixed breeds that just pull. They probably still have some husky in them, I bet, but other than that, not really. But the Malamutes have ears coming kind of towards the side, like you can see his are, and they have a curly tail. Huskies' ears are a little bit higher on their head, and they have a sickle tail, so their tail lays over their back. It is important in some ways because Malamutes, I don't know what I have here, but because Malamutes do have a tendency to be a little bit more dominant, whereas Huskies have a tendency to have more resource guarding issues. And Huskies resource guarding, I remember doing evaluations of Huskies, and the resource guarding issues are kind of like, what do you think you're doing taking my food? It wasn't, you know, the kind of hysterical thing or whatever, it's just like, this is my food, you can't have my food. So it's almost better to get people who are willing to, you know, just kind of give the dog something and let them have it, rather than trying to actually work on this behavior, because it kind of comes when you order the dog.
These are not hybrids with hard wolf in them.
Hybrids are a complete mess.
Yes.
So hybrids are, because they're part wolf and part domesticated dog, most of them are bred with Huskies or Malamutes. Some of them are bred with German Shepherds. They have a tendency to have a much higher fear component. Much higher fear component.
Makes so total sense.
Yeah.
And they're predatory tribes.
And they're predatorized out of this world. So they, and they can also be, when they're dominant, they are dominant. Man, so I had a consult with, I may have told you this, this was a husband and wife who had a female, very large female hybrid because it was sexy. I mean, really, that's why they got the dog. And they had a dog walker who was splendid. He was great. And the dog would actually obey the dog walker but wouldn't obey them. And if they did anything that the dog didn't like, she would go full on display. You know, she'd get the big teeth and all that kind of stuff. She never bit them. But she would do everything up to biting them. Remember I said their body language is really, really clear? This was very, very clear. So they were afraid of her. So they brought her in for a consult, and I said, you know, this is your dog. You know, make a life for her. Do as much as you can with you know, having a companion that you trust, but don't try to make her do anything, because I don't think you can. In fact, I did have somebody in a class once, years ago, who had a hybrid, and I said, my God, how can you, this is wonderful, the dog, you live with the dog, the dog is wonderful, you like the dog? He said, yeah. I said, how do you do it? He says, I let her do anything she wants. So these people, they actually took my advice, they were fine, everything was okay, the dog would, you know, if she got up on a couch, they'd go sit on another couch.
Oh my God.
It was like living with a mass murderer, you know, or something. But then they wanted to get a dog.
Oh,
and so they wanted to get a husky. Because they love this northern look. So we happened to have a husky at the shelter, and so we took her out with the husky, and we said, is she dog aggressive? And they said they didn't think so, but they didn't know. And so we had her on a drag line, and we had the other dog free. He was a really nice young husky, adolescent husky. And everything was fine, and they were both doing sniffing. They sniffed each other, they sniffed the world, and everything was fine. And then Trisha, bless her sweetheart, threw a ball.
Oh.
Now, huskies don't care for balls very much, but it was still activity, so, you know, something. And so the young husky started chasing the ball, and the hybrid took him down. I mean, so fast, it was like, wham! And then she stood over him, and she did this, you know, thing over him. She just stood there. And every time he moved, she'd get a full display. And so he'd stop moving. And so she just stood there. And the owner started coming towards them. And Patricia and I at the same time were going, stand back, stand back, stand back! Because she wasn't doing anything. She was just standing over. So they backed up, you know, and they backed up, and so she just lay on top of him every time he tried to move. And then she started to stand up, and then he kind of was wagging his tail, things at this rate. And then she just kind of went, we're done. And she stepped away. And everything was okay again. And we said, don't get another dog. And, but we'd come to find out, you know, she had this really big thick coat. He was kicking and hitting an e-collar over and over and over again. The entire time this was happening, he was hitting an e-collar. And she took no notice of it whatsoever. Not even a little bit. This was, you know, this was her business and she was taking care of it. And that's it. So that's a hybrid. So they're either scared, nut, crazy dogs who will, hybrids tend to chew up everything. They chew up your house. It's very, very difficult to house train them. Most people cannot house train them. And they can scale almost any fence. I had a friend who had hybrids and she had to put a roof on her. She had like a 12-foot fence. She had to put a roof on because the hybrids would get over and hunt deer. And of course the rangers didn't like dogs up in the air.
So are dogs like the Klee Kai, are they a miniaturized husky?
Yes, they are a bred-down husky. They used Pomeranians in them. Anytime you see these, and we have a segment today on small dogs, but essentially, I thought maybe they were a natural small dog, but I looked it up, and they're an intentionally bred small dog that looks like a sled dog.
They're hyper.
Yeah, well, you would be too if people kept making you smaller and smaller and smaller.
I know. I've met a few and all of it, and they're really smart.
Yeah.
But they're all.
And they're very independent.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're very independent. It's just, they spend a lot of time just giving you the finger.
Shiba, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
Exactly. Like
they probably use a Shiba Inu in breeding.
No, they're not bigger.
I have a client with the only friendly Shiba Inu in the world. It's a really nice dog. So this is just a piece of video. I can't even remember if it's got any point to it. Of a
pretty dog. That's
a
husky.
Yeah.
Eardrum.
Got a sickle tail.
Yeah.
What did you call it? Sickle.
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 It's over the
top. Okay. Sickle. It's not a
toy. So this was, the dog had leash reactivity, so I said, let the dog go. And he went towards stud.
See? That's another husky. That's fine.
Oh, it's another husky. It's not stud. But now watch him play.
Oh, okay with me.
So it goes from that full-on, I'm going to go get you thing to this kind of play. It's a really good example of leash reactivity.
Does he realize it's not a dog?
Not yet.
Oh, that's a really good question. We don't. No, probably not. But it's, you know, lots of dogs do, and some dogs do and some dogs don't.
Yeah.
Of the dogs that I worked this week and I had stud meet them, I think two dogs thought it was a real dog, could not talk them out of it, and two dogs went, that's a toy.
Yeah, so,
So other things about northern breeds, very pack-oriented, they're either non-territorial or have extra large territories. You know, like that's the whole thing about these guys, you know. It's 500 square miles, you know, so you can't keep them in there. Huskies are long-distance haulers, and Malamutes are strength pullers. Samoyeds are really family-happy dogs. Of all the northern breeds, the Samoyed is the least like what we think of as northern breeds. They have nothing in common with their roots do not have anything in common with Huskies and Malamutes. So they're breed apart. They just happen to have a lot of hair. They come from parts of, I think it's Georgia. Georgia is the country. Okay, potential, wandering, social dominance, intolerance, predatory behavior, resource guarding, very vocal. So this says, you may be trekking 2 or 3 feet of snow, living with you in Kentucky now, exercise me 6 hours every day or I'll eat this couch. Distinguished vocalist, yes, and very energetic. Okay, so now here's where you don't even bother to keep on going, because I did this whole thing this morning. Okay. Hunting and sporting dogs, Labrador retrievers, golden retrievers, Chesapeake Bay retrievers, Blackfoot retrievers, pointers, dogs like that. I'm going to go into that here. I thought this person's thing about labs is pretty good. This is the yellow lab. Traded brain cells for friendliness. Food machine.
Yes.
Chocolate lab is shaking. Pure insanity. Exudes demonic energy. And black, loyal, holding it together for everybody. It's just cute. It was like how to choose breeds, but we're going to go into that a little bit more. So these two breeds, the Labrador Retrievers and the Golden Retrievers, have an awful lot in common. So we do tend to lump them together quite a bit. They have differences as well, but the differences are fairly minor when you're thinking in terms of a family, you know, whether you're going to get a dog or something like that. So they are very versatile when they're raised appropriately. They're very affectionate, playful, generally extroverted. So, you know, for those of you who have an introverted dog, anybody here have an introverted dog? You have an introverted dog, you do, yeah. What's your dog?
Chevy, he's an Amstaff.
An Amstaff, and he's pretty introverted. So, you know, what we think of as dog is what these dogs are, with that whole like, oh, hi, how are you? Everything is good, right? They often are puppy-like well beyond their adulthood. So you get a five-year-old lab or a golden that acts like a two-year-old or a 10-month-old. They have, oddly enough, considering that they're hunting dogs, an extremely low prey drive. This would be because nobody wants them to kill anything that they bring back. They're just supposed to bring it back. So they don't have the chase part of the iStock, you know, progression, but they do not, and they chase and catch, but they do not kill. So of all the breeds, these are the ones. Now, having said that, remember I've had at least two, have had two consults where a lab and a golden both killed a small dog. So you can have it, it does happen. It's just that if you're going to say breed tendencies, the breed tendency is to have a low prey drive.
On the bridge backs, do they have a high prey drive?
Oh, very high.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so they should not be around little dogs ever, right? I know people who have, one person has like a Yorkie mix, and then their daughter and their kids got a bridge back.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, well, I'm like, well, you just need to be careful because...
You need to be careful, but certainly a dog with high prey drive can learn to live with a cat.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it can live with a small dog. The thing is that other cats or other small dogs might actually...
No, this is not living together. These two do not.
Then they should see each other a lot in order to know that the other one, that they like each other.
Okay.
You can remember that a dog has to learn what is prey.
Okay.
And if they don't know what is prey, and they learn that by the thing runs away and then they catch it and bite it, and then they go, okay, that's prey. Or they watch another dog do that. Okay, that's prey. In fact, you know, like buzzard hunting dogs, right? Aspen and Heather. You know, I've been bad owner, letting them do it every once in a while. I'll pull them in, bring them in. Tell them they're good dogs, you're not doing that every once in a while. I'll go to go. And what happens with intermittent reinforcement? What do you think? Anybody know anything about intermittent reinforcement?
Very reinforcing.
It's very reinforcing. So guess what they've done?
Oh,
they've expanded it. So now if they see a duck, they're chasing it. And they always let ducks go by with no problem. We have lots of geese where we are, and no problem with that. Then they chased a turkey the other day. So I'm like, so we can't do it anymore.
Does prey drive and predatory drift go hand in hand? If the dog has a high prey drive, can you assume that it could likely transfer to a household with a small dog, like minor, they run and squeal, and will that trigger?
Yes, absolutely. If you're not really careful, if you've got predatory drift is real, and if a dog has a high prey drive, and has, particularly if a dog has used that prey drive. So if a dog has caught a squirrel in the backyard, you know he's got prey drive, right? So then you take him in with a bunch of small animals, and if they run and remind him of a squirrel, then it can kick him right into that. So that's not a good thing. So predatory drift is definitely a strong tendency in our dogs. So the other things about these guys that are really cool is that they're often universal players. So many of these dogs you can see at dog parks, and they're playing with everybody. And if it's a big dog, they play big dog play. And if it's a little dog, they play little dog play. So they're just, they can be really good that way. And they don't have much of a temper in most cases. Again, not in all cases. And of course, the ones I see are going to be the ones that have problems, because I don't see dogs where people don't call me up and say, hey, Trish, come on over here and look at my great dog.
Let me pay you to look
at it. It was a good thing when I used to teach classes, because I'd see a lot of good dogs. Now I just see bad dogs, and I'm like, the world is filled with bad dogs, you know, that's that. The other thing that's interesting about these dogs, which I never really thought about until I started working with Bergen a while back, and also with Guide Dogs for the Blind, is these two breeds of dogs have a tendency to be able to shift allegiances from one family to the other much more easily than some of the other breeds. If you shift a heeler from one family to the next family, like apparently that heeler has gone back and forth, then they can't cope with it. It is not what they're supposed to do. But guide dogs, and particularly I think CCI, what they do is they place puppies with one family, and then they place them with another family, and then they move them in for training, and then they eventually put them in with the dog that they're going to be in with forever, or the people that they're going to be with forever. And that's a lot of shifting. They do it on purpose. Oh, in Bergen, what they do, and I actually talked to them about this, in any given year, they have students have a dog, one of their youngster dogs, for 3 months, and then when they change semester, they change dogs. And the reason they do that, they told me, is because the students get too attached. Well, how about the dogs? Which is what I said, no. How about the dogs? Don't the dogs get really attached? Is this necessarily good for the dogs? So I think they're still doing it. I guess they've weighed the pros and cons, and I am not an assistant dog trainer, so it may work out just fine. But it is interesting that if you did this to a German Shepherd, they would be a nutcase. It would not be able to do it. And that's one of the reasons why guide dogs drop German Shepherds. They no longer use German Shepherds. And if you could keep them in the same home, train them for what they were going to be used for, and then give them to the new owner, you would probably do okay. But, you know, when you have the dog born in a kennel and then go to a puppy home, and then go to maybe even a different home, so it is hard on the dogs. So these guys can take it even more easily. That makes sense? I mean, I think in common with most Americans, I think Labs and Goldens are wonderful dogs and I love them to pieces. And I think for most families, a dog like this is the appropriate dog. I've always thought that guide dogs should have a side business of pet. They're change of career dogs, go to pet homes. But I think they should have only get the creme de la creme for the guide dogs, and the other ones they should actually sell, I think. But they would lose their organization and their org, and they probably would lose a lot of their donors, so they don't do that. So the other things about these dogs that are really interesting is how willing they are to learn. They really want to learn, and the reason for this, and again, this is what's nice about typing all this stuff, is that it puts it all in order for me, stuff that I've learned over the years. They are probably the first obedience trained dog there was. Anyway, hunting dogs, not Labs as we know them, but some kind of retrieving type breed. Because hunting was our first occupation, and then when we kind of joined forces with dogs at some point in the far distant history, one would assume that was what they were used for. They were either going to be sighting the animals or bringing stuff back or pointing them out to us or whatever. So the hunting dogs have to have a tremendous connection with their people. They have to look back at their people a lot. They have to obey their people very quickly. And they have to be tough as nails because they're going to be going through all kinds of really icky environments to get to whatever they're supposed to be getting to. So what you'll find with a good Lab and a good Golden are dogs that are connected to their people, really are interested in pleasing them, and of course they'll work for food. Any dog will work for food. In fact, Labradors will work for even kibble. They'll probably work for the thought of kibble. But it, I mean, it, to me, it's just kind of interesting. Well, no wonder these dogs are really good, is because of what we bred them to do. They can take a lot of physical pain, which means when children jump up and down on them, they're not going to get really upset. And if you've watched, I don't know if you've ever seen the way hunters train, many, not all, hunters train their dogs, it's painful. First of all, they almost all use pinch collars, and as I've said before, I don't have anything against pinch collars. It's just the way they're used that I have a point problem with. They're the ones who use the ear pinch to get the dog to drop something. They would take a piece of chain, put it in their ear right here, and just press down on the ear until the dog opened its mouth.
That's a horse.
Probably kind of going, right? Yeah. Is that what they do in horse training too?
Some, usually the lip.
Lip, twist the lip, mm-hmm. Yeah. Till
it releases endorphins.
Yeah.
So sometimes they, yeah.
Yeah, so what happens is it's pressure on, pressure off training, but in this case it's also pain on, pain off training. And then they use something called a toe twist, which I do not know how it works, and I really do not know, want to know how it works, but it's pretty icky. So hunters also routinely use e-collars, and they use them at high levels. They use the first e-collars, which were just on, off, pain or not pain. And these dogs still love their owners, which is one of the interesting things that these people said was, you know, well, the dog still loves me. Yeah, wouldn't he love you more if you stopped hurting him? You know, but the thing is, they can take all this pain. So if you go to a trainer who has used this kind of method on their dog, and you take your Sheltie, what do you think is going to happen?
Nervous breakdown.
Yeah, yeah. They'll freak out completely. You can wreck them. And Tricia was at some classes years ago that she was not teaching. She was just in them. And she said that there was one trainer who, and in fact, my predecessor used to be really, really tough on dogs. And it's as though they don't know the difference between dogs, that a Sheltie or a Border Collie does not take the same, cannot handle the same kind of punishment as another kind of dog has. And I think that's because they have these kinds of dogs, or they have really, really stable dogs that are tough to start off with. Yeah.
So it sounds like the perfect set of breeds, right? I mean, it sounds really amazing. So. But there are such high, huge rates of cancer and early death.
Oh my God, yes.
Like the single digits.
Oh yeah, so you breed like this and you breed for specific attributes, mm-hmm. like these attributes, like being really tough, being easy, you know, wanting to please, all those things, and you get this phenomenal appetite that won't turn off. You could probably keep on feeding some labs and they'll just keep eating. And they would probably die from overeating. Because this is what we've done. And, you know, if a golden retriever lives to the age of 10, they're probably gonna live to the age of 14. It's making it to 10 that's so hard. Mm-hmm. It's when they get cancers and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, for sure. This is when bad becomes normal. Oh yeah, of course these dogs always used to get cancer. And it's a horrible trade-off that we're making.
Wait, I don't understand the question. How is cancer treated?
Well, the thing is, it's not that it's triggered, it's that when you breed for one thing, you often get something else. So what happens is they bred for these attributes, and little did they know, but they were breeding for a susceptibility to certain kinds of diseases. So their immune systems were not as good, for instance, or whatever. They also breed for, you know, they have a lot of incidence of knee problems. And that is not just because they are so athletic, this is also because they have a susceptibility to that particular kind of problem. Yeah.
The Morris Foundation is doing a huge longitudinal study on cancer in golden retrievers. Mm-hmm. And some of the stuff that they're just finding now is pretty interesting, but they're everybody's waiting. Everybody's waiting for the end to see what they're really going to come up with. But it looks like it's going to be a tremendous study, and it's the only one that has that volume of dogs and is longitudinal.
That's very good. I mean, it's really nice that they're doing it, but they should be taking their preliminary studies and putting their preliminary results and putting them out now, I would think, because there's so many of these dogs that died so young. You know, the worst thing, of course, that happens is if you're a breeder and you show dogs and you've got this absolutely gorgeous stud and, you know, he wins all over the place and then he dies at 8, his genes are everywhere. And then they're passed on and on and on to the point you don't even know who's what dogs have his genes. If you'd have known that he had a predisposition to cancer, you wouldn't have bred him. But a lot of breeders still will, because they're looking for, they can't see into the future. They don't have that. They don't kind of go, what am I doing to the breed down the road?
Yeah. And they don't get a lot of feedback either.
No.
You know, people who have the pups don't get back with them when something's happened down the road.
Yeah. Well, sometimes they don't get back, and sometimes, I mean, I've talked to a lot of people who said they've contacted the breeders, and the breeders never called.
Well, it's
not time that bad. So other issues, pika, eating everything. These are animals that eat almost everything, so they eat everything. And I've had several clients with dogs that eat tennis balls, and I've had to have surgeries for tennis balls, or electrical cords, or pretty much anything that we can get in their mouth. Coprophagia is also a big problem with them. Coprophagia is poop eating. It's not as big of a deal, except for it is to us. You know, we don't exactly like it, because then they want to lick you immediately thereafter. Way too energetic for many families when they're young. Because they are very energetic when they are young. If they're not energetic, there's probably something wrong. So they should be energetic. Leash reactivity. You see quite a bit of leash reactivity in these dogs, and male-male aggression. And I can't tell you why that we get more of that than other breeds of dog.
Does it matter if they're neutered or?
Male, no, this would be intact males going after, and actually neutered males too, but mostly intact male-male aggression. But a lot of male dogs don't have any aggression against other male dogs. I mean, you know, if we stopped neutering all of our dogs, they're pack animals, and half the world is male and half the world is female. So if they fought every single male, it would not be very conducive to world peace or anything like that. Yeah.
So when you saw Penny, the golden, is it common to have goldens that are that like anxious and fearful? Like,
it happens. Like, it happens with every breed, but it's not a breed-specific behavior, I should say.
Okay.
Now that doesn't mean it's not becoming more common.
Yeah.
Because again, you breed it and it happens, and it's going to keep on happening. This the Rhodesian Ridgeback Pit Mix that I saw yesterday. She, you know, this is genetic. These problems are genetic. They're not. I don't think she caused them.
No.
You can take a stable dog and train and raise him really badly, and he'll still be a stable dog. You take a neurotic dog and raise him badly, and they're going to turn into a psychotic dog. So, you know, that core that you've got is really important.
Right. Do you know why the leash reactivity?
Usually, I think that's because they are so I think it's for the same reason that other breeds are leash reactive. They're frustrated. They can't get to the other dogs, and then they get upset about it.
And so social. I was confused.
They're very social, and you take most of the leash reactive dogs and put them in a dog park, and they're fine. They just don't like that stupid leash. So really, they're fighting the leash more than they're going after the other dog. They just look like they're going after the other dog.
Yeah.
Now, some dogs really are aggressive, but that's pretty low. So this is a silver lab. This is the new kid on the block. God knows what's in the genetics of this one. I don't know. This was the one, remember I told you about the poor woman who got the dog that
diabetes.
She was supposed to be a diabetes sniffer.
Yeah.
And this is not that dog, but this is what that dog looked like. And these people that breed for this, that train these dogs to be diabetic sniffers, they only do silver labs. Which means they have a very small gene pool, which means probably that they got a really high degree of fear. For those of you who don't know, this dog cost, what did I say, $15,000. $15,000.
But her friends all pooled the money to buy it for her, for her child.
And then she got the dog, and the dog was terrified and growled at all guests coming in and didn't even do its job. And she couldn't take it back. They wouldn't take it back. They wouldn't retrain the dog. She's stuck. And as far as I know, she's still stuck. I don't know. Chesapeake Bay Retriever is very different from the other labs, the other retriever breeds. They're bred not only to retrieve waterfowl, and they do that beautifully. They are exquisite retrievers. They really do their job, but they also would guard the boats in the Chesapeake Bay. And because of that, they are guard dogs, and they are very strong-willed guard dogs. And most breeders will tell you this and tell you don't get one of these things unless you're absolutely sure about what you're getting. They are seriously territorial, seriously territorial. They are also serious workers. They have a tendency towards dominance in the home, so if there's a hole at the top, they'll take it very fast. And their colors include dead grass.
Seriously?
Yeah. Seriously. Sedge, which I don't know what sedge is. I believe mud is also one of their colors.
Yeah.
Light brown and dark brown. They have a slightly curly coat, and their coat is absolutely waterproof. So when I met my now ex-husband, I met him by training his mother's dog. He lived at home with his mom. And he was half Chessie and half Lab. And he was actually a joy to train. This was back when I was using traditional methods, and he went right along with it. Everything I wanted him to do, he did. It was really hard to transfer the knowledge, which anybody who does day training will tell you, it's really hard to transfer this. And so I required someone in the family so that I could train, and so they gave me Michael. I kept him for 17 years. So at any rate, I had never put it like that.
Maybe you should cut that for the video too.
No, I'm going to leave that in there and send it to him. We are really good friends. We have no problem with that. It's really hard to fight a woman to get really pissed off at a woman who leaves you for another woman. How do you do that? Doesn't make any sense. Okay, he was the first Joe Bear. We then named one of my Rottweilers Joe Bear, and he was really good when he was with me. He was very protective of Dorothy, my mother-in-law, and he wouldn't let anybody close to her. So, started going after children. And people who had hats on and stuff like that. And at the time, I was seriously, ignorant about stuff like that. But I said, I don't think that you should keep him because he's going to hurt somebody. And so they gave him to a farmer. And so I came to the house and showed the guy what the dog could do. And he could do everything, And the guy took the dog. And the dog went home and bonded with this the wife of the guy who took the dog. So it was really, really serious bonding. And one night, he would not let the husband in the house. He just wouldn't let him in. And so the wife eventually took the dog outside, and they had the dog because that was really pretty scary. But that's the kind of thing that they can do. They can be, and he was a boy, but he would go into swimming into Lake Tahoe in the middle of the winter, no problem. Mm-hmm. It was so cold and he had no issue with it whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So these dogs, if you ever get one as a client or whatever, take care. Because they're tough. They're really a tough breed. There are few dogs that I would say, no, I don't think I'm gonna do this one. This would be one of those breeds. Another breed, I'm not keen on some of the really big mastiffs like the Connie Corsos and dogs like that. I no longer will take those. Flatcoat Retriever also gets its own little page. It's a good retriever. It's not as popular as a Golden Retriever, or certainly the Labrador, but it's really complex emotionally. So they're like conflicted dogs. I don't know what it is. There's probably a very small gene pool, and so you have some characteristics that just get passed on over and over and over again. Because as they become adult, they often get people reactive. I wouldn't say people aggressive. I don't think they're going to go out of their way to bite somebody. But if they feel threatened, they'll bite. And I've seen this now in 5 or 6, and there's not very many of them around. But I've seen this particular tendency in 5 or 6 dogs. Now, having said that, I can tell you that back east, they don't have this problem. So they have it here, this reactivity in the flat coats. But there are more flat coats back east than there are here. And it's actually, you'll see this quite a bit. You see, problem dogs that we have here are not problems back east. And presumably are not problems in other countries.
Is there vice versa?
Because we've got gene pools. So there's a breeder of German Shepherds in this area who breeds some really lousy German Shepherds. But they breed a lot of them, and they sell a lot of them. So we see the same problems over and over and over again with those dogs. They don't have those problems in other parts of the country.
Do we have other dogs that are okay and they're bad?
Oh, Chihuahuas. I don't know. I actually should ask some of my friends back there. And if you've got any friends, ask if there are dogs that are just not problems. And they may not be problems here, too. Heelers are always somewhat problematic. But border collies, she laughs every time. She always thinks that I'm talking about her dog.
What have I done?
Oh, but she was just so cute. Like, how could I say it was?
She's also a nice dog.
She is a nice dog.
Just because I'm saying these things about these dogs doesn't mean it's true.
I think because of our experience with Buster.
Yeah. Okay. Once you've had a dog that it has been, you've been unable to save, it's really hard to go to the next dog. So these dogs also are more sensitive than other retrievers. They are, and they again can become reactive to dogs and to human beings as well. Portuguese water dogs and poodles, water retrievers, both of them, and I put them both in the same bag because they are the same kind of dog. Poodles are so kind of everywhere, you don't remember what they are. They're hunting dogs and they're water hunters, and the reason they have those funny coats, you didn't know that?
I did not know.
Okay, so the reason they have these funny little poofs here, and you've seen the ones with lion cuts, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where they have the hair here, and here, and this poofy little puff spot here right on the neck. Those are because when the dog goes into the water, those protect the joints there from the cold water. And they shave the rest of the dog so that the dog doesn't get waterlogged. And they often will do the same kind of thing to Porties as well.
Mm-hmm.
Both of these dogs have hair. They do not have, they don't have fur like the rest of our dogs do. They don't shed, which is, of course, what people like about them. But they do require a lot of cutting because of that. But next time you look at a poodle and go, that's just a poof dog. There was a reason. Now, most poodles are not used for water sports anymore. But guess what? The gene's still there. If you put them in the water, they love it. They really, that's what they were bred to do. They really like to do it.
Are the large ones coming back?
I've seen quite a few of them.
Have you?
Yeah.
Because I know when I was a little girl, they were
popular. They were very popular, yeah.
It's doodles now. Everybody does doodles.
I know, we're going to get to them. They have their own pace. To stop it?
Yeah.
As far as I know, not a thing.
Yeah.
They do. They keep their dogs well. They certainly don't mistreat them. They probably breed them too much, but there's no proof on how much breeding is good breeding.
There's no websites,
At this point, there probably are. Just like there's a website for these people who breed the Silver Labs. But if you're if you're going to buy a Silver Lab or you want a diabetic dog, you might not look at that first. You look at that after you've got the dog that is not working out for you. So you could be proactive. You know, there are Yelp pages, I presume, for these kinds of dogs and whatnot. But it's so hard because when people say, I got a bad dog from this breeder, the breeder comes back at you, and they do, and says, that's your fault. We bred a good dog, you screwed it up. And this happens all the time.
So they don't have licenses? That's not regulated?
No, there's no licensing. No.
That's sad, actually.
No, uh-uh.
But I think the breed that I know of shepherds that are in the South Bay is breeds a lot for police dogs and stuff. So I think if you're going to go to that person, you're going to know that dog is going to be bred for that. That's pretty, a lot of them are aggressive dogs. I mean,
But people just think, oh my God, it'll protect my family. They forget that the dog doesn't know what they're protecting.
Right.
You know, they don't know that that guy's a good guy and that guy's a bad guy. So you get a protective dog and they protect against everything. Much better to have a big dog that barks and then runs away. You know, or put a, you know, bark, bark, bark doorbell in or something like that. So water retrievers are really energetic, really energetic. If you have them swim every day, they do pretty well. But just imagine what kind of muscle tone it takes to swim every day. These are dogs with a lot of stamina. They're extremely intelligent. They're very good at solving problems. They can figure out how to get out of places and into places and stuff like that. Yeah, so it's, you know, this is not necessarily the dog for most families. They do not rely on humans for their, you know, remember I was talking about the Goldens and the Labs that rely so strongly on their people. Once you send a 40 out, they go out and they get what they're supposed to get. They don't follow your instructions when they're out there. The Nova Scotian Duck Trolling Retriever is a really interesting hunting dog, by the way, because what they do is they actually go out and look like they're gonna play with the ducks. Bring the ducks in. And then they get shot there. Fascinating. So they pretend they're a duck. Because it's duck trolling is what that's called. So these guys can be very challenging, and one of my most challenging cases in all time was a Portuguese water dog that scared the living daylights out of me. And that was a dog that was owned by a woman who had lost her husband and her mother in like a period of 3 months and was really lonely and was putting all this love and affection and everything on the dog. And the dog was taking it and was, you know, turning it into the world is about me. And I was actually walking with a dog, and he turned and looked at me with murder in his eyes, and he went for my arm. And the only reason I got him away from him was just because I had to pull him like that. And then she took him. And then he went for Tricia at another time. And it was interesting, it was at a clinic. And we were talking about him, and I said, you know, I'm sure he's a lovable dog. And she goes, what's not to love? He bit her. Oh. If she tried to groom him, he'd bite her. He wanted to kill the other dog in the household, to another Portuguese water dog in the household. So yeah, it wasn't really good. So, and I actually think he probably started off to be being a pretty good dog, but the relationship was so skewed. He was her husband. She thought he was, and he thought he was. And he wasn't a really nice husband. So it didn't work out really well. But they're so smart, they can start doing this stuff, and the poodles are also really, really smart. They can figure out what's going on. The other problems you see with poodles is occasionally you see some prey drive, but it's not really an enormous problem under most circumstances. The thing they like most for prey is cars. Doodles!
Oh, gosh.
So these are all portraits my daughter did for a dog walker. These are her client dogs.
She doesn't have a daycare.
Okay. But she's in Southern Marin, where guess what? There's lots of doodles. So these are all the, you know, all the doodles that she was taking.
What's her business called? What's her business called?
Robin?
Yeah.
Robin King Art on dog.
Okay. No, I know the art, but you said dog walking too?
No, Robin didn't do dog walking.
Oh, she did.
Okay, gotcha.
There's a dog walker.
Okay, good. Okay, no, I got confused.
Hired.
I thought, okay.
So I got permission to use all these pictures because I'm like, oh my God. She said she got so tired of doing doodle hair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a question back to the poodles. I was told that poodles, I guess more specifically the toy poodles, were also used to protect little girls. They were given to little girls to be like their own personal guards. Do you see
that? I've not seen that.
Okay.
You could look it up. Look it up and let us know.
I was just going to ask if you knew them to be protected over, like, you know, one specific person.
I haven't seen that.
Okay.
I haven't seen that. Doodles are poodles and labs are goldens, generally. Of course, doodles can also be burner doodles.
Yeah. Oh, jeez.
Cute.
They're really cute.
I know they're really cute. And actually, it's not a bad mix because burners usually are pretty calm and hello, everything's good. So if you're taking a poodle and mating it with a burner, that might give you a calmer doodle.
Uh-huh. I've had a couple burner noodles. Dying my dog.
Yeah, we're good. I'm good for that then. The problem is that when you take a poodle with these independent, intelligent, hyper-alert dogs and mix them with a Labrador, extremely energetic, food-oriented nutcase of a dog, you get, you know, when it's young, right, you get, oddly enough, dogs are like, whoa, you know, and they can be like that for a long time. Now, having said that, I have met some really nice doodles. But I've also met some doodles that are not really nice. And the guy, Wally Conran, who developed the breed in Australia, says he's sorry. The thing is that the dogs are so different, that the individual dogs are so different, that you don't see a whole lot of breed specificity here. It kind of goes all over the map. But as I said here, biggest issues involves too much energy, willfulness, and too much energy. Both of those.
Are they recognized as a breed?
No.
Noodles are not,
no.
Right?
Although it's really funny because people will do that. Oh, it's a purebred noodle. You know, you can go to the shelter and get a purebred mix there too. Really cheaper. Yeah.
Purely mixed.
Quite a bit cheaper. Will it shed though? Will it shed? So some more hunting dogs is the Weimaraner and the Vizsla, the German Shorthair and Wire-haired Pointers. All three are very affectionate and cuddly until something happens to get their attention and then they're gone.
Which
ones?
All of them?
Yeah, all three. Weimies and Vizslas are prone to separation issues, big time.
You move over a little bit.
You mean, no?
Yeah.
Are Pointers
all
too?
All or
nothing. Huh?
Are Pointers too? Because I have no one with separation anxiety.
No, Pointers don't, they're not necessarily prone to it. But of course they have it. Every animal can have it. I think one of the reasons that Weimies and Vizslas have it so much is because they tend to be pack animals. And so I think they have isolation anxiety more than anything else. But Weimies also get so attached to one person that they just can't separate themselves from that person. And I also think, and this is something that I think Temple Grandin thinks as well, is that they have so little coat, and the dogs with this no coat at all, you know, they have a more tendency to anxiety. And heavily coated dogs don't.
Wow.
Now, just ask Strider. He had a lot of coat, and he had separation anxiety. So it obviously doesn't follow through with everything, but I think there is a point at which this happens. The interesting thing about these dogs is these are the dogs that, all three of these types of dogs, are the dogs that eat colors and use on the most. Because once they get going on something, once they catch a scent of something, they forget you exist. And in order to get them back, they have to use e-collars on them. And I actually agree with their use of e-collars in this because it is a recall kind of cue to get the dog back into proximity with the owners again. It can backfire. My brother had I think it was a short hair pointer, and she was a really nice dog, and we went walking. And he had gotten it, he was e-collar training her. And he had, by the way, he trains eagles and hawks and animals like that. He does it all with opera conditioning, all of it with clicker training and all that. And here he is with this e-collar on his dog. And I'm like, you don't see that there might be a thing here? But anyway, so, and he didn't bother to do a whole lot of training. It's just he did reinforce her when she came back. But other than that, he didn't do a whole lot of training with her. I think he liked to do the raptors more. And so she got out of range of the e-collar, and she left. And she went across the freeway, right down the road. I guess she went on the overpass, because she ended up in the village. And then the second time she did it, she got killed. So, you know, he was counting on that a little bit too much, I think. I think she needed more training instead of just this kind of lackadaisical training that he was doing. Couple more dogs and then we'll take a break. Spaniels, Cocker, Springer, Irish Plumber, cheerful, friendly. These dogs were bred to go and make things get excited. That's what they're for. They would be sent into brush so the partridges would come out. So they're flushing dogs. There's not a lot of training that has to happen with flushing dogs. They go in there and they go, boo! And all the birds come out, and then the hunters go bang, 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 bang. And then they go to the next bush, and they go boo again. So now you know why spaniels are the way they are. Hi! Hello! Because a good spaniel is just cheerful, friendly, happy, very, just delightful to have around, really nice, nice companions. And this is not the Clumber Spaniel. I have yet to figure out why Clumber Spaniels actually exist. They look like they're trying to be a slug.
Yes.
Giant bones.
So you have to look it up. I didn't put a picture of a Clumber in here. The biggest issues involve resource guarding. That's a really big deal with these dogs. And I imagine it goes back to some kind of genetic something, maybe a breeding many, many, many years ago. Chewing, barking, they do tend to be pretty bad barkers. And very occasionally something called rage syndrome. You're having a conversation over here.
What is rage syndrome?
I'll tell you that in a second. Just we have to, I don't want to interrupt Aspen. And
they're having a moment.
I don't know. This is the thing, you know, she runs this place, so obviously. Okay, rage syndrome is the dog, it usually starts with a thing. So it usually kind of starts with a resource of some kind. So it happens most often in Springers and Cockers, although it has happened in Bernese Mountain Dog, which is kind of interesting because you wouldn't think it would with those dogs. So they may have something, and they get a very glazed look on their eye, in their eye. And then instead of just being resource guarding of the thing that they have, what they do is they'll launch at somebody. So they actually will go across the room and launch at a person walking by. So it's as though they think that that person is coming to take this away, when in reality nobody is doing anything like that. So it's kind of hyper suspicion at the same time that the dog is resource guarding. And that's what we see the most of it. The thing clinically is that the eyes go flat and black, so they dilate actually to the point where you don't see any other color in there. And the dog seems to go into a seizure-like behavior. So currently that's the thought, is it's a seizure. The dog has actually caused himself to go into a seizure and they're not really kind of with it. In the case of Springer's, it was traced to one dog in 1985 or something like that, who won big in Westminster. And I don't know if there was a similar tracing in the Cocker breed, but both of these dogs have a tendency to resource guard. So this is how it comes out. Most veterinary behaviorists think of this as being dominance aggression. I don't think of it as being dominance aggression because it doesn't have any of the other characteristics. You can be sitting on the couch with the dog and move the dog and it's fine. You can have the dog in the bed with you and move it and it's fine. It's just that every once in a while something like this clicks in and they go into this kind of seizure-like behavior. The times I've seen it like three, maybe four times, it's scary as hell. One of them was a young Cocker Spaniel. It was in Sausalito. And I went to the person's home because she said she had this puppy. I think it was like 4 or 5 months old, and she was scared to death of the puppy. So the puppy would get into these rages, and then she ended up on a coffee table to try to get away from the dog. And she was worried because the dog was going to get bigger and not be able to get up on the coffee table with her. Reasonable thing to worry about. So I got over there, and the dog was just as sweet and as cute and as wonderful as possible, just absolutely adorable. And I'm like, God, this lady's actually so And she said, well, it normally happens when it's on this bed. So she gave him a little toy, a little chewy thing, and she put him on a rug in the bathroom. It wasn't even a bed. And she said, you know, I'm not going to go over there. You go over there. And again, this was a long time ago, so I didn't put a leash on the dog because I was pretty stupid. And I walked over there, and when I got, if this was the dog here, I got to this point. All of a sudden, I had a little Cujo right there. And I picked her up and I held her like this. And she was like screaming, yelling, and turning around and all that kind of stuff. And I looked at her eyes and there was just no dog there.
Wow.
And this was like at 4 months of age.
Wow.
So my recommendation to her was to return the dog to the breeder because this was a purebred dog. And I said, I don't know that it would be possible to actually be prepared for this, to try to modify this behavior. This isn't what you're... Most people sign up to have a pet, not a problem. And I think that was the case. Yeah.
I have one friend who was a spur trainer, was very happy, you know, when you just come up and say hello. And then as soon as someone interacts, which the dog seems to want, they pet around for a few seconds, then the dog bites them.
Oh, I've seen this too. Yeah, in springers. It's kind of weird intolerance.
What is it?
Well, I don't know. It's actually, if it were a cat, I'd be calling it, you know, intolerance aggression, the like affection aggression the cats get, where you pet the cat once, it's fine, pet the cat twice, it's fine, pet the cat third time, then nail you, right? That is, so they just can't handle that. And I think that is a tactile thing. So if I were going to pet a dog like that, you know, I pet him like this, they can't handle that feeling of touch. They really want they want the affection, they want you to love them up and everything, but as soon as you touch them, they can't handle it. So what I would say with that particular dog, what I would do if it were my friend, is I would pet the dog one time only. And then when she came back, or he came back and asked for more, I pet him one time again. And what happens then is you can work up some tolerance over a long period of time. So it's one and a half, two. And then you pull back and you wait till the dog comes back at you. So unless it's dominance, if it's dominant, that isn't dominance. So because it's a stranger, okay, it doesn't have to be the owner.
Correct.
Yeah, no, that's dominant. That's intolerance. And so yeah.
Have you seen rage in other breeds? I have heard one time Goldens can pop up.
Yes, I have heard of it in Goldens. John Fisher used to say that it happened in Goldens in England. He saw it there. I've never seen it in Goldens.
Just right about it.
Yeah.
Back to Vizslas, I thought of it when you said something about seizuring. I've known a few Vizslas that will tend to work themselves up and go into a seizure. Is that a common thing for
them? That's actually, I've heard of that in Vizslas and some of the other hunting dogs who don't have some kind of off switch.
Yeah.
Yeah, they just keep on going and going and
that's
going.
What
and
I
going.
Found
and they either collapse or they seize.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are quite a few dogs that will actually collapse and die.
Oh.
They do not know how to regulate themselves.
Even
so you do have to watch out for them.
Like
yeah.
Just being
yeah, that, they still will do that. And then there's another thing that labs get, which also comes from overexertion. It's called cold tail. Have you heard of that? It the tail just drops straight down and they can't move it, and apparently it's extremely painful. Because if you touch the tail, they scream.
Oh, what's it called?
Cold tail. Yeah, and
their
it kind
whole body freezes or just their tail?
Just their tail.
And that's a
just their tail. No, they're actually probably what happens is they cut off all the circulation to it. And it gets really cold. It does it does go away over a period of days. But it takes a long time and it's really, really painful.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's mostly in labs.
And is it when they get wound up?
They just work too hard. They do too much. You know, there are people who actually don't know when they're too tired.
Yeah.
You know, there are people who just keep on going and going and going and then collapse. So that's the same kind of thing I think in dogs. Okay, let's take a break.